You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
You want answers!
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
I see dead people.
All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it! My life has value!
Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swaby is part of the critical conversations currently taking place across the film community. The podcast reaches out to the next generation of filmmakers who continue to look for inspiration and guidance. Remember to hit the subscribe button and leave a comment in the comments section. Share the podcast with friends and family and have a great day. And now, over to the host of the show, Damian Swaby.
Hello and welcome to Filmmaking Conversations with me, Damian Swaby. Today on the podcast, I'll be speaking to a brilliant young editor. This editor started editing at the age of 10. She is currently studying digital media, film production and public relations at the Marymount Manhattan College. I'm talking about Megan Arnold.
I wouldn't say that I came to school as a filmmaker. I think I came as like an aspiring filmmaker, but I did come with like, I mean, I've been editing on like iMovie and like Premiere and like all these little film editing programs and stuff since I was like 10. So I think I just came with like this passion and knowledge of the technology and was able to apply that to my education.
A film education is vitally important. There's a big debate about film schools. Should people still go to film schools or should they just learn online? I think the best way to become educated as a filmmaker is to be educated in the way that suits you best. But one thing we must certainly all agree on, it is vital that we all have an understanding of film history. Like this guy says, who took 3 attempts before he got into film school.
I come into contact with a lot of young people, and I found that a lot of these people know all my movies really, even better than I do. And they know all of Marty's films, and they know all of Brian De Palma's films and George Lucas's films, and they're getting to know all of Quentin Tarantino's three films. And, you know, but what's happening is, they don't know much beyond that. And when I say, what are your favorite films from the old days, from the black and white days of the 30s and 40s, I don't get a lot of answers that give me comfort. And I'm finding that if people are going to just study the movie brats of the 1970s, you know, what they're learning is a pretty weak carbon copy, because all the movie brats learn from the masters of the 40s and 50s and 30s, and I'm sure those in the 50s and 40s learned from the silent movie masters. And so we're all handing influences down and inspiring from generation to generation. And I kind of am a little bit sad that a lot of the young people today kind of have a cutoff point for their own personal influences, and that's like, they don't know a lot of pictures in the pre-60s. My kids will always ask me, is it in black and white? Because I always show them movies, and their big fear is it in black and white. And when I say it is, they don't want to see it. So what's true is the first knee-jerk reaction of my children is they don't want to see a black and white movie. But then I say, you're going to have to. You're just going to have to. And I promise you, 10 minutes into the picture, they don't know whether it's in black and white or color, whether it's 1:6:6 or 2:3:5 aspect ratio. They're into the movie. And by and large, when they like the movie, when it's over, they're raving about it.
And for those of you who don't know, that's a filmmaker who had one or two hits and would have many more, Steven Spielberg. One of the film movements that's always been close to my heart, and I think right now, after COVID and once this pandemic is finally all over, is a film movement that we can all learn from and use as independent filmmakers.
Following in the footsteps of the French poetic realism movement in the decade prior to the 1930s, Italian neorealism focused on the struggles of Italian life in post-World War II. From the monetary trials to the moralistic principles of characters coping with survival in war-torn Italy, we take a look at Italian neorealism. During the height of Mussolini's power during World War II, he nationalized Italy's cinema, creating Cinecittà, or Cinema City. In charge of Cinema City was Vittorio, Mussolini's son, who was an avid film lover and critic. The intention of Cinema City was to centralize all production. Films were written, shot, and edited at Cinema City. A majority of films produced at Cinema City during World War II were Telefono Bianchi films, or white telephone comedies. White telephone comedies were films that held conservative values and featured characters who respected authority figures. White telephone comedies were incredibly popular, with hits such as Paradiso and The Defeat of Hannibal. After Italy's defeat by the Allied forces, Cinema City was deemed unusable by Italian filmmakers, as it had been badly damaged. So, Italian filmmakers began thinking outside the box, and took camera equipment out into the streets, relying on natural lighting and working with unconventional acting techniques. The filmmakers to begin this method of filming were originally Italian film critics during Mussolini's regime. These critics attacked the white telephone comedies, finding the films to be obtuse and uneducated. These critics found solace in the poetic realism films coming out of France, feeling those films told true, natural stories. They were also influenced by the docu-like style films of Alessandro Blasetti, a prominent Italian filmmaker during the Mussolini years. By combining elements found in poetic realism and what Alessandro Blasetti was doing in his films, these critics, now turned filmmakers, began a new and revolutionary film movement. The first neorealistic film to be produced was Accession, in 1943 by Luchino Visconti, 2 years before the fall of Mussolini. Accession was based on the novel The Postman Always Rings Twice, and tells the story of a drifter who falls for the wife of a restaurant owner. A relationship starts between them, and they conspire a way to murder the restaurant owner. The film is renowned for highlighting the mundane activities of its characters, particularly in one famous shot showing the wife simply making herself a bowl of soup. Scenes like this are riddled throughout Accession, and had an influence on future neorealism films. The film was released on May 16, 1943, and was quickly banned by the fascist government, fearing the influence the film would have on the lower-class citizens of Italy. The government confiscated all copies of Accession and destroyed them, except for one. Visconti hid one copy, and after the war, Visconti tried to get the film released into theaters in the United States, but was blocked by MGM, who held the rights to The Postman Always Rings Twice. Visconti had not obtained the copyright or permission to adapt the novel. Eventually, the film was allowed to be screened again in Italy in 1976, 33 years after it was initially released. The film that opened the gates to Italian neorealism was Roberto Rossellini's Rome, Open City. Rome, Open City tells the story of a man trying to evade Nazi capture during German-occupied Italy. Rossellini wanted to convey the tragedy of the Italian people done by the Germans and Mussolini, giving texture and depth to characters traditionally not seen in Italian cinema. When the film was released on September 27, 1945, audience believed the film was a documentary, as the way the film was shot. Surprisingly, Rome Open City didn't go over well with audiences. Moviegoers wanted escapism, films like the white telephone comedies, as the destruction and devastation of the war was still so relevant, so watching a film on that subject matter wasn't exactly wanted. However, outside of Italy, the film was well received, even winning the coveted Golden Palm Award at the Cannes Film Festival. Some countries did not take the film kindly, though, including West Germany, who banned the film until 1960, and Argentina, who also banned the film. Probably the most well-known Italian neorealism film is Vittorio De Sica's 1948 The Bicycle Thief, a humane story about a struggling father desperate for work and relying on his bicycle, which gets stolen, and the journey he takes with his son to retrieve it. The film is often considered to be one of the greatest films of all time, and has been referenced in countless movies and television shows. The film laid the groundwork for understanding what Italian neorealism truly was. Films shot and set in the open, away from studio settings, relying on the moment lighting, focusing on characters who are struggling against not only themselves, but against the environment they are placed in. An interesting tidbit about the translated title when the film was released in the United States was the change from the original Italian Bicycle Thieves to The Bicycle Thief. A happy accident when New York Times reviewer Bosley Crowther accidentally labeled the film The Bicycle Thief, not its original Italian title, Bicycle Thieves. People have been critical of this accident, as the now translated title has become synonymous with referring to the film. While some feel the title is more fitting following the reveal at the end of the film, showing the son watch his father steal another bicycle when they cannot locate their original, making the father a bicycle thief. Another Italian neorealism masterpiece made by De Sica is 1952's Umberto D, and it tells the story of an elderly man who struggles to pay his rent. The film is unrelentless, showing the despair people will go to survive, an element audiences were getting tired of. At the time of Umberto D's release, the Italian neorealism movement was considered to be finished. Italian society began to yearn for social change, and having films hammer in the message of disparity over and over again became tiresome. Italy experienced what would become known as the economic miracle thanks to the Marshall Plan, so films about impoverished characters were no longer fashionable. The films of Federico Fellini became popular in the mid-1950s, films that were sometimes referred to as transitional films. These films were part social awareness with elements of escapism. While Italian neorealism did come to an end, it had profound influence on filmmakers, and still does. The movement helped pave the way for filmmakers to take their cameras away from sets, and to make stories about the struggle people may have in life, something as simple as paying rent.
Have you thought of upgrading your cinematography game? Would you like to have an ASC cinematographer mentor you for free? Join veteran cinematographer Suki Medenzovic, ASC, Disney, Pixar, FX Networks, Netflix, American Horror Story, as he teaches you how to create beautiful images using three lighting techniques he has mastered on film sets over his 30-plus years in the film industry. Each technique uses basic, low-cost lighting equipment so that anyone can achieve beautiful visuals no matter your project's budget. If you want to take your cinematography to the next level, visit filmmakingconversations.com to sign up for instant access. If you like this podcast, share it with friends, leave a comment in the comment section, and hit the subscribe button.
Megan crowdfunded her first film, her first serious short film, and it sounds very, very interesting, her film. So I asked her a few questions about the film itself and how the crowdfunding experience was.
I think it's kind of just a personification of how I tend to over-romanticize relationships, whether they're good or bad. And I wanted to kind of, I usually do like horror, or like, that's kind of what I've been diving into as a film student. So I wanted to push myself to create something that was more dependent on human emotion. And so I wrote the story about two women in a relationship and how it grows and also falls apart at the same time. And yeah, that's kind of all there is to it.
So why did you have certain expectations about relationships? And what was it about those expectations that made you want to make your first serious short film about them?
I think I've always been like a very emotional person, and a person that's like just wanted to be in a relationship. And I think when I got into my first relationship, I think I just took a lot of the good and bad feelings that I had from that and wanted to make something out of it and kind of a way to heal from it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm kind of using this film as therapy.
Okay. I appreciate your honesty. Some filmmakers actually really do that. I had one filmmaker on here who said basically the same thing. It's a kind of a therapeutic situation you're putting yourself through. But even though it's therapeutic, absolutely, you have something that you need to finish and you want to make. How does that affect your decisions when it comes to casting the film and getting people to be a part of the crew?
I knew who my crew was going to be pretty early on, and it was a pretty small crew. So I had my assistant director, her name is Maddie Drogsbeck. She created a film 2 years ago called Aphrodisia, and she's just amazing. So having her on board was just great. And then I also had Nick Bradshaw, who was my cinematographer. And these are just friends from school that I know. Right. And so I just really trusted them with my vision and like everything like that. And then as for casting, there's only two people in the film. So I wanted to take as much time as I could with the casting in order to make sure that they were perfect and they were like exactly what I needed. And I think I got that. So I'm excited for that just to see. I mean, already seeing them like editing and like posts and everything, it's like great. And I just can't wait to see when it's done and see how other people react to their acting.
So when you say you got exactly what you needed via the casting process, what exactly did you need?
I wanted people who were able to embody the two characters, Nina and Claire. And I think I wanted the film to be just about them, like just about two people. I wanted them to have chemistry. I wanted them to be gay in real life, or like gay aligned. And I wanted them to just be able to use their emotions well and have that be picked up on camera. But yeah, and I think I went in to casting having a very specific view of what I wanted. But then when it came to it and I chose Mimi Perez and Marissa Moreau as my leads, they kind of surprised me and like added more layers to the characters I had already written, which I think is great. And I was surprised and I absolutely got exactly what I wanted.
Oh, wow. Very lucky. I'm happy for you.
Yeah.
And it can it can go other ways sometimes, you know, in that way.
I agree. Yeah.
And the shooting schedule, what was that like in the whole process of going through being on set?
Well, with COVID and everything, it was complicated because I didn't want to have multiple shooting weeks. And I wanted to make sure that everyone was able to be there so that it could just be like quick and easy. So it took 3 days to shoot. And we were on location for 4. So I'd say on set, it wasn't that bad. I think planning it and kind of like working up the nerve to walk in there and like be a director and be everything else that I was nerve-wracking. But once we got there and everyone kind of got to know each other and got in the flow of things, it was seamless.
Excellent. How many members of cast and crew were there all together? Because did you have a runner, makeup, hair?
Everyone kind of did like 5 jobs at once. Great. I'd say. So we had Mimi and Marissa, who are the leads, Claire and Nina. So that's 2 people. And then it was me, my assistant director, Maddie, my cinematographer, Nick. We had a sound person, Phil, and a script supervisor. And then we also had a intimacy coordinator on set for half a day, twice. So they came 2 times, but only for a few hours. So there weren't like too many people on set. But everyone kind of did a lot and kind of like worked together to make sure that it all flowed.
And what was it like working with an intimacy coordinator, and where did you find such a person?
It was I'm really glad that they were there, because I think it made everyone feel very comfortable, and it also took a lot of pressure off my shoulders when it came to actually shooting the scene, because I don't know. I knew what I wanted in my head for that specific scene, but I also didn't feel like I was the person to kind of tell them to, like, oh, move your arm here, do this, do this. So it was, I was lucky that
Acacia. What was the scene about?
It's basically just like an intimacy scene. That's kind of
a kiss and a cuddle.
A little bit more than a kiss and a cuddle. But it does, it is like a big transition into a different scene that I think is one of my favorites. But it's very visually, it's very appealing, like cinematography wise. And it's just kind of like a intimate scene. I don't really know.
Okay, it's your favorite scene. So why were you glad the intimacy coordinators were there? Why did you feel it wasn't something you could maybe grab the bull by the horns?
Well, I meant like the scene after it's my favorite scene, or okay, one of my favorite, but no, it's okay. I think having an intimacy coordinator on set is very important, especially in this time of like the Me Too movement and just kind of like making sure that everyone's comfortable and that there's consent involved and that people's emotions are being cared for. And so I knew what I wanted for the scene, and I told Acacia, the intimacy coordinator, that, and they just made it happen. And it was nice to be able to just focus on lighting and like where the camera would be and props and things like that, instead of having to choreograph something intimate, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So this film itself, once it's finished, it's edited, graded and everything, what is your ambitions for it?
I am hopeful that it can be accepted or chosen to be in a few festivals. I also would really like to have some sort of a premiere at hopefully a gay bar or a lesbian bar in New York, because there's not really many lesbian bars left in the United States, and I think it'd be cool. I think there's only 15, if that, and that was before COVID.
In America?
So, yeah.
Wow.
So I think it'd be cool to make it a premiere, but also some sort of fundraiser for both the bar and just LGBTQ charities and things like that in general. That would be really cool. Yeah, I think every filmmaker wants to be accepted into a festival and win something. And I think even just being considered would be awesome.
And in terms of the film itself and fundraising, how did you fund the film? And do you have any ongoing funding situations involved with the film?
I used GoFundMe, and then I just annoyed everyone that follows me for 3 months. I think that's how you found me, right? It was through Twitter, I think.
Yeah.
I did not stop tweeting about it, or posting about it on my Instagram, but mostly Twitter. We got, I think, like $100 more than the goal was, and the goal was $2,500.
Good on you.
I think we have like 60 people that donated, which is just crazy. The amount of people that, most of them I knew, but they were a lot of people that I just didn't expect to be supportive, or like not supportive, but like didn't expect to actually like put money into it. So that was really cool, and now I just hope that I don't let them down.
And I'm sure she won't let them down, and I can't wait to see this new film. It goes to show, when you think about crowdfunding, you never really know who's going to back you. All you can do is set yourself up to put yourself in the best place. To not just hope for the best, but to think you'll get the best result. Editing a film can be quite complicated, and it can be very hard and even stressful at times. What software do you use is something that comes up a lot. At the moment, for my own projects and corporate work, I'm using Lightworks. Due to Adobe Premiere Pro not particularly working the way I would hope for in 2021. Editing is important. I didn't start at a young age, but someone I know certainly did.
So when you're 10 years old and you pick up iMovie to start editing, what were your influences? Like, what would make a 10-year-old decide they want to edit rather than play Super Nintendo or Xbox or something along those lines?
I wouldn't make anything too crazy. I think we would make, that was around the time that Paranormal Activity was out.
You couldn't have been watching that then.
Yeah, but I would watch like the trailers. My mom actually wouldn't let me watch the movie. I would watch the trailers and be like, this is so cool. And like the whole found footage idea, I was like, oh, I have a bad camera too. Like I could probably make something as well.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what sparked that. I would make like horror stuff. I would also be watching like reality TV shows. So me and my sister would put a camera up somewhere and then do like fake confessionals and fake, music videos, just kid things. But I loved being able to just sit there and make it come to life. I thought it was the coolest thing ever.
Oh, I see. That's nice of your mom to let you watch the trailer. I mean, that's kind of something you may have sneak away to watch. And the found footage, would that be stuff you would download online or you would literally find the footage?
I think it was more of the Blair Witch Project and like Paranormal Activity. Those are kind of like within the realm of like quote unquote found footage things. So I would like pretend it was found footage, but really I would just like film it and make it look scary and then edit it together.
Good on you.
Yeah, nothing crazy.
And what would you have been using back then? Because you said you had a dodgy camera. Was it like, father's old camera or?
I think I would just use my mom's like MacBook, photo booth camera.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then I forgot what they're called. Like they were like little, like the flip cams or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got one of those for my birthday one year. So I just abused that and just filmed everything.
You love editing. It sounds like I could see you with like a mirrorless camera in your hand, shooting something and then maybe editing it. Is that something that appeals to you now?
Yeah. I don't think I'd be able to say I'm like cinematographer and video editor. I don't think I have enough knowledge of cameras to say that. But I'd like to just shoot things, edit them, and then see what I can make of it. Same with like directing. I just like anything that's behind the camera really and behind like everything else. I feel like I can take over.
You've never tried to act?
Oh, I have.
Oh.
And that's why I know to stay behind the camera at this point.
Well, why do you say it was that bad?
Just like middle school theater and things like that. There's definitely no acting career for me in the future, I think. So I will continue with editing and everything else.
So now you're 21. In 10 years time, when you're 31, where do you see your career being?
I can see myself being someone with a multitude of projects in my pocket that I can show off and like prove what I've done. I'd like to be able to say that I've done this, and this. I don't know. I think it's very like 10 years, that's crazy. I just hope to be alive and be happy and healthy and still doing what I love. But it would be very cool to be someone, I don't know if I would say like be someone in the industry, quote unquote, but just someone that's able to continue working and still have love for it, even at 31.
So. Good. I'm sure you will. Have you been editing since you were 10 and you're editing at 21? I'm confident you'll be editing at 41.
I hope you enjoyed. today's episode of Filmmaking Conversations with me, your host, Damien Swaby. And thank you so much for listening.